we are going to take a look at Psalm 139. And if you spend some time reading the Bible, you can't avoid the book of Psalms. It's right in the middle of your Bible, for one. And secondly, in a book filled with remarkable things, and I'm talking about the Bible, the book of Psalms is remarkable in its own special way. Because there's 150 psalms, and every one of those psalms is unique and powerful and speaks with an eloquent voice of our heart crying out to God in some way or another. Now, many of the psalms were written by King David. Some, I'm sure, before he became king, some during his reign, but collectively, and tonight the psalm we're going to take a look at was written by King David. You're going to see that this is such a powerful and eloquent expression of a person's heart before God. So let's take a look here. I'm just going to jump in. First of all, reading the title. I do want you to notice that when the Psalms give a title, now I'm not talking about the title that the Bible translators or publishers give it. For example, in my Bible, the New King James Version, it says Psalm 139, and then in bold words, it says, God's perfect knowledge of man. That's something that the publishers just put in there to give sort of a title to the psalm and a summation, which is fine. There's no problem with that. We just recognize that's not part of the text. But when it says below that, for the chief musician, a psalm of David, those words are from the original Hebrew text. It's part of the psalm. And so from this, we recognize that this psalm was first of all written to a particular person for the chief musician. Now, some people wonder who the chief musician was. Many people suggest it was Asaph. It was one of the other Levitical leaders of song in the worship of ancient Israel. And that's entirely possible. But I'll give you my always estimation. I always believe that the chief musician was David's wonderful and poetic way to refer to God himself. God being the chief musician, the one who created music. In any regard, it's for the chief musician, and then it says a psalm of David, telling us that this psalm was authored by David, the son of Jesse, the king of Israel, the one that the book of 2 Samuel calls, and I love this title for David, the sweet psalmist of Israel. And I tell you, this psalm is sweet. Verse 1. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You've hedged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. David prayed with great passion of heart, directing his prayer to Yahweh. Do you see that in the first few words? O Lord. And when Lord in our Bibles is written in those small capital letters, it's a reference to the covenant name of God with Israel, the name Yahweh. And David prayed to Yahweh, understanding that Yahweh has personal knowledge of David and his life. You see, the pagans often thought that the gods were hostile to humanity or indifferent to humanity. I mean, after all, if you think about it, you think about the Greek and the Roman gods. What interest did they have in mankind? The occasional passing interest, but for the most part, they didn't care a thing about humanity. But not so with Yahweh. David understood that Yahweh was a God who cared about his people. Look at it there. You have searched me and known me. David knew that God cared about him so much that he searched him and he knows each man and woman. Now notice this. It's not enough to say that God knows everything. He knows you. It's not enough to say that God is everywhere. He's everywhere with you. It's not enough to know that God created everything. He created you. It's not enough to know that God so loved the world. He loves you. And David understood that. You've searched me and known me. I like the words of that great Puritan commentator, John Trapp, that I like to quote from time to time. He said this, "All my postures, gestures, practices, whether I sit, stand, walk, lie, you search and knowest all. Some search, but know not, you do both." So to illustrate this, look at verse 2. He says, "You know my sitting down and my rising up." That's sort of a proverbial phrase in the ancient Hebrew language, just to denote, you know everything about me. You know the most everyday things about me. As Jesus would later say, and I think it's in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus would later say that God knows the numbers of hair upon your head. He knows you. He knows you deeply. By the way, a commentator, his name is Van Gemeren, he points out that the Hebrew grammar here in this phrase in verse 2, "you know," the emphasis is on you. In other words, you know. It's even you. God himself has this great knowledge of me. Verse 2, "you understand my thought afar off." You see, God not only knows the smallest aspects of David's individual and everyday life, as he does with us as well, he also knows our thoughts. Doesn't that blow your mind? He not only knows your actions, he knows your thoughts. He knows your words before you speak them, and there's nothing hidden before this all-knowing God. As it says there in verse 3, "you are acquainted with all my ways." Now, by the way, I do want to point out that there in that phrase where it says, "you know every word on my tongue," that should give us a little bit of pause, shouldn't it? If God knows every word on my tongue, as it says there in verse 4, shouldn't that make me careful about how I speak? Shouldn't it make me careful about the vocabulary I use? If you would speak a particular way in the presence of God, you are in his presence. He knows every word on your tongue. And then it says in verse 5, you've hedged me before and behind. Now, when the Bible uses that idea of a hedge, it normally has the sense of a protective barrier. In ancient Israel, they would grow thick, thorny hedges and surround vineyards or orchards with these thick, thorny hedges, and it was meant to keep out predators and pests and things like that. The idea is that God hedged David in on every side, not to trap him, but to protect him, so that nothing could get to David unless it had gone through God first. Think about that. God himself was the hedge. Now, we need to think about this for a moment. When David presents God looking upon us, knowing us, examining us this carefully, this closely, for some of us, that disturbs us. Look, I don't think I've lived in a police state, but you know, you wonder what would it be like to live in these places where every word, every thought is under scrutiny, where everything is being examined. You know, we get this technology that we bring into our homes, something like the Amazon Echo, and you realize it's listening all the time. And supposedly it's only activated when you say a certain word, but it's listening to you all the time just for that word. And we can get this strange idea that God has us under hostile surveillance. You see, folks, it can be very uncomfortable to know that we are watched at our every move. We can get nervous if we see that video camera or know that the microphone is on us. Yet our unease is based in we doubt the good intentions of those who are watching us. In other words, you see the person who on the work site has the camera on them and they're at the cash register. And what does that camera say? You better not steal. We got our eye on you. You take one thing out wrong and man, our eye, it's a little bit uncomfortable, isn't it? But then what do we think of the video monitor that's in the baby's room where the mother is in the next room? Well, that's the camera of love. That's the camera of concern and care. When we understand who God is, it is a great comfort, the same way that a child is comforted, that a loving parent watches over them. We are confident in the care and love of our God and Father. His constant knowledge of us is a comfort and not a terror. That's why he says, verse 5, you'd laid your hand upon me. This is not the hand of oppression. It is the beautiful touch of God's grace. That's why David says in verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. What does he mean by wonderful? Basically, what he means is it's just beyond him. In other words, I can't even know myself as well as God knows me. Now, I want you to ask, do you really believe that? I want you to believe that. I want you to believe it because it's true, and I want you to believe it because the Bible says it. I have to come to grips with the fact that God knows me even better than I know me. And if I really believe that, then when God tells me to do something that I'd rather not do, I understand the God who knows me even better than I know myself, he knows it's in my best interest. I mean, I believe I'm a fairly rational person most of the time. And if I really knew what was best for me, I would choose what was in my best interest. But look, let's face it, friends. The same way that a child doesn't always know what's best for them, that's how I am before God sometimes. But I recognize there's a God who knows me even better than I know myself. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. Now, before we begin at verse 7 and consider the next section of this psalm, one thing that I often think about when I read the Psalms is I wonder what kind of tune went along with David's singing of this psalm. What did it sound like? Was it a song like we think of a song? Was it sort of poetic words? You know, did it sound like a poetry slam? You know, was it kind of thing, just kind of these words with sort of a chanting kind of accompaniment with music in the background? I don't really know, but it's interesting to think about. Some kind of music David is beautifully playing, and as he does, these words pour forth from his heart. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to you. Here David is considering that unbelievable truth that God is present everywhere. Did you see what he says in verse 7? Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I possibly go? There's no place I can go in the universe that you are not always there. David considered the truth of what we call in theology God's omnipresence. God fills every corner of the universe. But at the same time, I want you to understand, David was not a pantheist. God was everywhere, but God is not everything. God is separate from his creation. In other words, your spirit, your presence, you are there. Those things are not part of God, yet he is everywhere in every aspect of the universe that he has created. And David recognized in the very best way, everywhere he goes, God is there. Now again, I just want to remind you that if somebody is everywhere we are with a bad purpose, we feel like we're being stalked. We feel it's dangerous. We feel it's time to call out the restraining order. Oh, but this is different with a God of love and care and concern. Verse 8, he says, even if I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. Now, I have to say, I don't believe here that David described what we normally think of as hell. That is what the New Testament calls Gehenna, or the lake of fire. No, the Hebrew word used here is the word Sheol, which normally has the sense of the grave, or by implication, it has the sense of the afterlife. Now, David didn't use the specific word for hell. The sense is the same. You see, even in the world beyond, even if I were to go to heaven or to hell, you would be there. And this leads me and many others to the conclusion that oftentimes hell is at least a bit misunderstood. Sometimes people think of hell as the place where God is not. I would question that. I would say hell is the place where God is present. Again, being omnipresent, he fills every corner of the universe. But God's presence in hell is restricted to his judgment. And if you were to take every other aspect of God's character out of the mix, you took away his grace, you took away his mercy, you took away his long-suffering, you took away all those other things, and all that remained was judgment, well, God would be there, but it wouldn't be pleasant at all. So if I go to heaven, you're there. If I were to go to hell, you'd be there. Verse 9, you take the wings of the morning. You know, David's probably considering how quickly light travels across the universe. And even light itself can't outrun God's presence and knowledge. Because verse 10, even there your hand shall lead me. David was so assured of the constant presence of God's love and care, that God's hand would be with him, that not even death could separate him from God's love. God, you will hold on to me even in death. Now, this is wonderful because we know from reading the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, we know that the understanding of the afterlife in the Hebrew Scriptures is somewhat shadowy. It's not clear. It's not only until the coming of Jesus Christ, as it says in 1 Timothy, that life and immortality came to light through Jesus Christ. It gives us a much clearer understanding of the afterlife. In the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, they didn't have the same understanding. But even David knew, your hand, or maybe put it this way, I will not be beyond your hand and your touch, even in the world beyond. Even then, verse 11, even the night shall be light about me. God's constant presence with David was like a constant light in the darkness. Think about that. As the pillar of cloud illuminated Israel in the wilderness, so it was with God's presence. Now, we pause here and we think, what a beautiful psalm. God knows everything about me. God is everywhere. God is close to me. And then we think for a moment, why this song? Brothers and sisters, this psalm might have come out of a beautiful, sweet season in David's life. Oh, Lord, I feel so close to you. I feel you're right close to me. I feel your presence. I feel your love. I feel your care for me. It's like filling the whole universe. It could have come out of that, could it not? But isn't it equally, or perhaps just in a slight way, even more likely that this psalm came out of a season of challenge? If David was anything like me, well, look, I'm not going to take the rap for this at all alone. If he was anything like us, let me say, don't you think it's possible that David sang this song to teach himself, to preach to himself? That this was a song that David sang to himself when he felt that God was far away? God, I feel like you're distant, but I'm going to choose to believe the truth about you, that you're near. I feel, Lord, there's something blank. There's something empty. I don't know if you're there and you care, but yet I know by the truth of your word you are. So I'm going to sing that you are. Listen, don't think that these beautiful, soaring psalms come only from somebody just walking in the high atmosphere of love and grace. Listen, sometimes these songs are sung from the pit. Sometimes they're sung from the heart of a person who so desperately needs to know something of God's presence and says, no, I'm going to ignore the feeling I have that God is distant from me, and instead, I'm going to sing of his nearness to me. Now, I can't tell you for sure because we're not given a specific context of why and when David wrote this psalm, but you and I know that such songs can come from the pit as well as from the heavens. Yet David found great comfort in this. Look at this at verse 13. For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they were all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. Notice this. God knew David. He's come back to that theme. God knows all about me. God is everywhere. Now he's back to the theme of God knowing all about me. Lord, you knew all about me before I ever emerged into the world. When I was still in my mother's womb, you knew all about me. It was speaking of the fact that David understood God knew him from before his birth, and God was there over his conception and development in the womb. Now, let me make a very obvious point here. The fact that God knows and cares for children in the womb, isn't this what this says? That God knows and cares for children in the womb. It means that God's concern for life begins when the child is in the womb. And if there's a place to date that other than conception, I know nothing of that. It means that God's people also have a responsibility to know and to care for children in the womb and to do whatever we can to preserve life in this world, to preserve that innocent life in the womb. Now, I know that in our modern age, it is very common to argue for the right for abortion because the mother has the right to do with her own body as she pleases. I understand that. That's the predominant argument made in favor. It's my body, the woman would say. I have the right to do with my body as I please. They might even say I have a God-given right to do with my body as I please. And in the most part, we would say, well, yes. We do have the right to do with our body as I please. I would just recognize this from Psalm 139. This demonstrates that God sees another person in the woman's body. Isn't that clear? When David says, I'll read it again, verse 13, you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. David understood that he was distinct from his mother from the womb. And so without any desire to legislate what a woman would do with her body, we would recognize the presence of another person who must be cared for and protected. And so David continues in verse 14, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. You see, David, the son of Jesse, what a remarkable man he was. Think about this man. You know, he was a shepherd, was he not? He was a hero, the slayer of Goliath. He was a special forces commando as a soldier for Israel. He was a poet. He was a king. And if you want to add one more thing to David's resume, add scientist to it. Because doesn't he give a pretty good understanding here? I am fearfully and wonderfully made. With the mind of a trained biologist, David declares with poetic skill, Lord, you knew exactly what you were doing when you designed me, when you made me. Now, I am not a scientist. I don't want to be a preacher who pretends that he is. But let me just tell you this. From what I read, from what I know, the human body is amazing. God has designed a brilliance in the design and workings of the human body that is staggering to behold. And David understood that. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Just like David, this should make us more full of awe and praise, because don't we know a lot more about the glory of the human body than David ever did? What would David do if he knew about ultrasounds? If he knew about DNA, if he knew about genetic studies, if he knew about this, if he knew about that, we know so much more about the human body. We should be praising God even more than David did. Because when David said, again, with poetic skill, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, we find out he was understating the case. And then in verse 15, and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. I think he's just using the poetic phrase there. I don't think, you know, he's trying to make some reference to the abyss or Hades or anything like that. I just think he's making a poetic reference to a mysterious, unseen place, which in this case was his mother's womb. There's something being formed in the mother's womb that we don't see, that we don't understand, but it's being skillfully wrought. Now, I need to say a word here. And I'm saying it just because I think it's an appropriate place to make a statement like this. When we see David speak of somebody who's skillfully wrought in their mother's womb, it makes us think about the phenomenon of birth defects. What if it seems like people are not as skillfully wrought, but they're born with some kind of difficulty from the womb? Well, what does that mean regarding God's work? Does that mean that God messed up? No, I would say this. We should regard birth defects as injuries to God's original design. And just as much as a person out of the womb can be injured in some way, so there can be some injury, and I know it's not a perfect analogy, but just go with it for a moment. A person can be injured in the process of formation while still in the womb. Now, just like all such injuries in the womb or out of the womb, they're a result of the fact that we live in a fallen world and the corruption that was introduced in the world through mankind's original rebellion. But listen, even as a person who is injured outside of the womb, we would say, you still have a place in God's plan. God has not abandoned you. God has a way that he can work something good and glorious even in the life that you have with your injury. We take the same idea with someone who was injured, so to speak, in the womb, in the process of formation. And we say that it doesn't diminish the fact that you are a precious one made in God's image, and God will want to work in and through your life just as he would through any of his creation. Now, he says, your eyes, verse 16, saw my substance. And then verse 16, in your book, they were all written, the days fashioned for me. God's perfect knowledge extends to the past, is true in the present, but was even for the future of David and his life. Now verse 17. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they'd be more number than the sand. When I am awake, I'm still with you. Considering how God cared for David and filled David's life, it made him respond to God with adoration, with amazement. It's precious that God would think even once about us. It's amazing that God would think about us all the time or to such a degree. Again, he's not alarmed that God knows all about him. It gives him comfort to know that. Or, to paraphrase a modern preacher and writer, Tim Keller, it's no good to be known and not loved. It's no good to be loved and not known. More than any other person in the universe, God knows us and he loves us. That's the glory of it all. That's the preciousness of his thoughts towards us. And the number of them, look at there in verse 18. If I should count them, they would be more number than the sand. Again, you want to know how much God thinks about you? Go out to the beach and look at the sand there. That's the analogy David wants to make. And it's not that you should go out and count every grain of sand and think each one represents God's thought. Shouldn't you say, it's a lot. It's more than you can number. That's how much God thinks about us. I remember reading Charles Spurgeon on this point. He relayed a funny story. Or let me just read it to you. He says, you know that people are very proud if a king has merely looked at them. I've heard of such a man who used to boast all his life that King George IV once spoke to him. And what did he say to him? He said, get out of the road. But it was a king who said it, so the man felt greatly gratified thereby. But you and I, beloved, can rejoice that God, before whom kings are as grasshoppers, actually thinks of us and thinks of us often. Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful thought? So David understood day or night, God was with him. Look at there in verse 18. When I am awake, I'm still with you. Now, verse 19 is an interesting shifting of gears. I mean, so far, hasn't it been beautiful and poetic? God, you know all about me. God, you've made me wonderfully. God, you fill the universe. And then I don't know if David changed up the music there in verse 19, but look at what he says starting there. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloodthirsty men, for they speak against you wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate you? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Now, I'm not going to say that verses 19 through 22 are the most important verses of the psalm. I don't particularly believe that. But I believe that they are important in this psalm. And let me give you two reasons why I think they're important. First of all, you understand what's being said here, right? David almost cries out with all of his strength, "Oh Lord, slay the wicked." He instantly shifts from this spirit of wonder and adoration to now active prayer against the wicked and against bloodthirsty men. And again, it's not so much that David was concerned for his honor. Why did he do it? Look at verse 20. For they speak against you wickedly. David's adoration of God filled him with a zeal for God's honor. And then he says very boldly in verse 21, do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate you? David was undeniably on God's side. And he wanted to be on God's side, and therefore he allowed himself to hate those who hated God. David even boasted that he hates them with a perfect hatred. Now, I'm not saying that we should imitate David exactly in this. I think we do have a proper understanding of what Jesus commanded us in the Sermon on the Mount, that we should never return evil done to us with evil to another person. We should never return hatred done for us with hatred towards another people. Jesus told us to love our enemies and to not hate them. That's an aspect we would not want to imitate David in this, but there is an aspect in which we should want to imitate David, and it's simply this. We should want to imitate David in the fact that to love God is to hate evil. Now, let me tell you why I think that this section of the psalm is important. First of all, it guards us from the misconception that many people have, and I don't know any better terminology for it, but what we just might call the hippie Jesus. Come on, you know the hippie Jesus, don't you? You know, Jesus walking through the flowers with a daisy in his hair. And he's just love, love, loved everything. And listen, we do not deny that the Son of God was full of love. Absolutely, he was. But it wasn't this passive, bow down before evil, accommodate wickedness, weak love. It was a strong love that knew how to boldly correct sin and to make a stand for righteousness. Yet it was real love. We know this because sinners were not turned off by Jesus. They were attracted to him in some sense. But this sense that God is just kind of this bland kindness towards any and every one and thing, instead of God being the one who establishes a moral order in the universe. And when you oppose God, you're opposing his love. No, David understood this, that to love what is good meant to oppose what is evil. So this section reminds us, no, we're not going to give in to the deception of the hippie Jesus on the one side, but on the other stand, we are going to understand that in this day, when we have the attitude, or at least our culture has the attitude, let's say that it's very possible, even preferred, to love God without hating evil, we have to pray that God would give us a clear moral sense. I love what one of the older commentators I like to read has to say about this. His name was George Horn, and he said this. Listen carefully to this quote. We are neither to hate the men on account of the vices that they practice. Okay, pause right there. Do you know people who practice certain vices? We're not to hate them because of those vices. But then he says, nor to love the vices for the sake of the men who practice them. This is our call. We are to, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, but sometimes cliches are helpful. We are to love the sinner and to hate the sin. Now, I know sometimes we think that's impossible. How can I love the sinner and hate the sin? Well, I'll tell you, it's not as hard as you think. You want to know how I know? Because you and I, we do it all the time towards ourselves. I mean, we love ourselves, but don't you sometimes hate the sin within you? I do that pretty good with myself. I love my sin. Excuse me, sometimes I do that too. Let me put it this way. I heard somebody express it very well. I hate that I love my sin, but I hate my sin, but I still love myself. We do it with ourselves all the time. And so there really is that dichotomy that can be made where we hate the sin and we love the sinner. Now, when we come to verse 23, we're in the last two verses of the psalm. And what a way for the psalm to continue, or to conclude, I should say. You see, think about the flow of the psalm from the beginning. God, you know all about me. God, you fill the universe. God, you knit me from my mother's womb. God, I'm distressed at the evil in this world. God, would you do something about the evil? I want to stand with you against the evil. And in verses 19 through 22, left you thinking that David is some kind of self-righteous. Oh, I'm so holy, and those sinners get away from me. If you think that's David's attitude, you don't understand David. Let him set us all straight with verses 23 and 24. Ready? Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties. And see if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Listen, if I was going to teach a class on theology, who is God? What are the attributes of God? I might run right to Psalm 139. Who is God? God is all-knowing. He's omniscient. He knows everything about us. That's in Psalm 139, isn't it? God is all-present. He's omnipresent. God fills every corner of the universe. That's in Psalm 139, isn't it? Oh, there's great theology in Psalm 139. And as someone who likes theology, I'm attracted to that. But you know one of the great things about the Word of God? It will not let us be with the mere theological or theoretical. David takes that understanding of theology and he says, now I want to apply it to real discipleship in my life. God, you know everything. God, you fill every place. God, you love good and you hate evil. Then it's as if David rips open his heart bare before God and he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. God, I need you to put the eye of your examination upon me. David knew that even he could not understand his own heart at its depths. So he says, God, I want you to know it. One man quoted by Charles Spurgeon said this, I call upon you to be cautious in using this prayer. It is easy to mock God by asking him to search you while you have made little effort to search yourselves and perhaps still less to act upon the result of the scrutiny. In other words, isn't it mocking God if I say, search me, O God, and know my heart, when I've made no effort to look at my own life? And it's an even greater mockery to say, search me, O God, and know my heart, when I have no intention whatsoever on acting upon what God may show me. But when we come ready to look at our life, ready to do what God would lead us to do, then what a beautifully God-honoring prayer this is. Matter of fact, sometimes I think I can know of no more God-honoring prayer than this. This is very much akin to the prayer of the publican that Jesus said in the Gospels, where the man just beat his breast and he said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Lord, I know this is who I am before you. So search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any wicked way in me. Lord, I want you to show me any unknown or unperceived sin, and I'll humbly come before you and ask that you search me. If you pray this prayer sincerely, that's a dangerous prayer, don't you think? But it's a worthy prayer. It's the prayer of a true disciple. Then finally, and this is a majestic end to a majestic psalm. You see this in verse 24? Lead me in the way everlasting. Lord, I believe that as I trust in you, the God who knows everything about me and still cares about me, the God who fills every corner of the universe, the God who loves good and hates evil, the God that I have laid my heart bare before, I pray that this God would lead me in the way everlasting, that you would lead me home to heaven. What a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful psalm this is. The way of holiness recommended to us in this psalm. This is the way everlasting. I think the world is changing so much. I think the gadgets that we have all around us and the speed of our culture have a way of making it so hard for us to just listen. So would you agree to pray that prayer in your life? To pray it and to really listen for God's response. He'll speak to you. Now, I think when God speaks to us, see if there be any wicked way in me. I don't think he reveals everything to us at once. Wouldn't that like crush us under a waterfall that we could not handle? So don't be surprised if you pray that prayer and God says, let's work on this and maybe this. Don't think for a moment, hey, cool, only one or two things. Maybe it's the one or two things God is showing you right at the moment, but that's fine. He knows what you need to handle. And when he works in your life through those one or two things, what do you do next? You go, all right, man, glad that's fixed. No, you go back and you say, okay, now God, search me and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And with that kind of heart, we'll see ourselves growing in the Christian life and walking in the way everlasting. Father, this is our prayer.